This is Women's Focus on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick, and we continue my interview now with Diana B. Enriquez, author of The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust. The Securities and Exchange Commission investigated Bernie Madoff a number of times, but never pinned anything on him. I asked Enriquez why he was able to dodge regulators.
Well, one of the reasons he was able to hide in plain sight, if you will, is that they didn't know he was managing money. His basic regulator was the National Association of Securities Dealers, now called FINRA, which regulates brokerage houses. And so when they came to visit, they were auditing and examining his brokerage operation, that legitimate business that operated up on the 19th floor of the Lipstick Building. Its customers were Merrill Lynch, Charles Schwab, Fidelity Funds. It traded stocks wholesale for all the biggest institutions on the street. Its books and records were meticulously maintained. He kept that legitimate business squeaky clean. At one level, that disarmed his regulators. Another strategy he used, which was even more diabolical, was to point suspicious people at the wrong crime. There were lots of sophisticated investors, particularly in the latter years of this fraud, who, if you put them on a lie detector and said, "Is Bernie Madoff 100% honest?" would not have been able to give you yes as an honest answer. They suspected that he was cutting corners. Specifically, they suspected he was front-running. Now, front-running is a form of insider trading. That's illegal, and it's a crime. Not a big crime, but it's a crime. Lots of people thought Bernie was front-running. And Bernie, I think, actually encouraged them to think that. He certainly encouraged at least one team of SEC investigators to think he was front-running. He had a confrontation with them and said, "Well, what are you looking for? What are you looking for?" And one of them said, "Well, what do you think we should be looking for, Bernie?" And he said, "Front-running. Aren't you looking for front-running?" Well, he kept directing them at the crime they would never pin on him because he wasn't doing it.
So these private investors and the feeder funds, did they think that he was actually taking their money and funneling it through Bernard Madoff Securities and doing actual trades? Is that what they thought was happening?
They thought he was using an analytical tool that he had devised, a computer-driven trading tool that allowed him to go in and out of the market, trading in Fortune 100 stocks for short periods of time to capture the very best of the market. Now, he told his own firm he was conducting these trades with counterparties in Europe. He was so clever, he would tell foreign auditors that he was trading with U.S. banks, and he would tell U.S. regulators he was trading with foreign banks because he knew that the difficulty of doing cross-border investigations would deter anybody from asking the second and third questions. So this is a guy who knew the regulatory landscape down to the ground. He knew where its weaknesses were, he knew where its pitfalls were, and he knew how to play them like a pipe organ. None of them actually knew how much money he claimed to be trading, because if they had, they would have suddenly said, "Wait a minute, that would take more Microsoft shares than exist." But he had kept his big investors, his big streams of money, in separate silos. So they really didn't know that there was this whole other group of investors who were sending money to Madoff, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars. They only really knew about the stream of money they were sending Madoff. And if he could keep those streams separate, each of them would look plausibly small to make it reasonable, perhaps, that he was pursuing this real strategy.
Some of really well-respected financial funds quietly started blacklisting him and not investing in him, but never told anyone that.
That's, I really think, a question that Wall Street really needs to wrestle with. There is a culture of silence that you simply do not blow the whistle on other people on Wall Street. The notion of an honor code that I will neither lie, cheat, nor steal, nor tolerate those who do has never found a home on Wall Street. And until it does, regulators are always going to be up against that wall of silence. Think how differently this would have turned out if the whistleblower who kept trying, Harry Markopoulos, kind of an odd guy.
That was a fascinating character.
Unable to communicate clearly with people who weren't as smart as he was, but thought he could, rubbed people the wrong way, suspected everybody, trusted nobody. If that very flawed but very determined and in some ways kind of noble whistleblower had had the backing of a half dozen really respected figures on the street, practitioners, people who were hedge fund managers themselves or industry consultants or private bankers, if the SEC had gotten calls from them too, not just from Harry, would this story have been different? I don't know, but I think it's a question that Wall Street really needs to keep asking itself, and we need to ask that question of Wall Street too. You know, the SEC has greatly upgraded its whistleblower program. It has extended its bounty program so that people who turn in bad guys on Wall Street can share in some of the money the SEC collects in fees and fines. So it is trying to encourage people to swim against that current of silence. I hope it's successful, because until it is, we're still going to be in the same shape we were with Madoff.
Madoff's investors never got unusually high returns, but they always got steady returns, regardless of what was happening in the market. And that's because the returns were all fake. He never invested their money, but used later investors to pay off earlier investors. But some Ponzi schemes often have very high rates of return, such as 20 or 25%. I asked Diana Enriquez why more people didn't question such results.
That is the classic Ponzi scheme, and I share your skepticism that people could have somehow deceived themselves that this was appropriate. Now, different asset classes, assets that you don't understand very well, you may not twig to how out of line these returns are. I talked to some Madoff investors who, when I said that to them, look, you were getting 8%. And at that time, you know, treasury bills were super safe. That's as safe as you thought you were. But they were only paying half that. And one of these was a retired school teacher in New Mexico. And she said, I had no idea what treasury bills were. I never looked at the business pages. These were folks who truly had no idea what a reasonable rate of return was. A lot of baby boomers came of age in the great bull market of the 1980s, and they started investing maybe in the late 70s when you could get 22%. You could get 13, 14, 15% on a bank CD. They came of age at a time when the stock market was gaining at an extraordinary pace, where you could put your money in the Magellan Fund and see it double in 5 years. So the generic investor, uninformed about the changes in the market, might well not have seen these rates of return as highly implausible. But see, that's what investors need to know. If you're investing in something, what's the general rate of return in that asset class? You know, if you're investing in the stock market, what's happening to the S&P? Now, that wouldn't have helped you with Madoff, because he was careful to always pay you an appropriate rate of return. So it wouldn't have helped you a lot with Madoff until markets became so volatile. And then you probably should have started to wonder, well, how come everyone else is swinging, you know, 100 points this way and 100 points that way, and Bernie's not? He would have had an answer for you, but at least you would have asked the question.
Diana Enriquez makes a compelling case in her book, The Wizard of Lies, that neither Bernie Madoff's sons, Andrew and Mark, nor his wife, Ruth, were involved in his fraud. None of them have been the subject of investigations or prosecutions, yet they have been publicly vilified in a way that Enriquez said is unheard of.
Historically, I've never seen anything like it. It's very rare. I can count on one hand the number of instances in which a close relative, an unindicted, uninvestigated close relative of a white-collar criminal has been subjected to the kind of scrutiny and the kind of vilification that the Madoff family experienced. They were dragged to the whipping post of public scrutiny And it was really surprising to me. It was stunning to Madoff. He told me that that was the one thing that really blindsided him. He was completely unprepared for the public attacks on his wife and children. He knew they were going to be financially ruined. He knew that. But he thought that by standing up, pleading guilty, confessing what he did, going to prison for 150 years, he was carrying the guilt. It never occurred to him that the public would never forgive Ruth, Mark, and Andrew, that they would continue to be under fire and under attack. And he couldn't do anything about it. The one time he broke down in prison when I interviewed him was in the first interview when I asked him about his wife's decision to stay with him after his arrest, which brought her great vilification, although I will point out his sons cut him off immediately, and they were vilified anyway. So he grieved at how his family had been treated, and of course his son's suicide just shattered him. I saw him in prison. My second interview with him was 2 months almost to the day after Mark's suicide, and I did not recognize him. When I entered the visiting room at prison, same room I'd interviewed him in August, the previous August, I thought it was maybe a janitor. I did not recognize him as the man I had interviewed in August. He had lost an enormous amount of weight. His uniform was rumpled. His shirt button was unbuttoned. I mean, the dapper dandy Bernie Madoff. He looked gray, badly shaven. He was shattered by the death of his son, Mark. And I think to the extent that I had never really been able to perceive any authentic feeling remorse in Madoff up until that point. Denial, yes. True remorse, no. In that encounter, I did begin to think he was finally learning that that the cost of his crime couldn't be calculated just in dollars and cents, that his crime had destroyed people's lives, and it had just destroyed his own and destroyed his son and his wife's life. So I think that might have been perhaps the first step towards genuine remorse that Madoff felt.
You'd said before, when you started the story, you could see the Shakespearean dimensions of it, and I think you just showed why.
Madoff was a man. He wasn't a monster. He was a human being, a deeply flawed human being. I mean, tragic in the Greek sense of tragic. That is, a person with enormous gifts, enormous possibilities, who because of a fatal flaw in their character, destroys themselves. He destroyed himself and everybody else who trusted him. Yes, there is a dimension of his story that is timeless, truly timeless. It wasn't a crime of the moment. I know a lot of people like to connect the Madoff fraud with the bubble decade, with the fall of Lehman and all of its aftermath. That they see the Madoff crime as kind of rooted in that period. That's wrong. That is profoundly wrong. Madoff neither was a product of that bubble nor a creator of that bubble. Indeed, his fraud began, we believe, long before that bubble decade. Men like Madoff will always be with us and always have been. They'll find a way because we're hardwired to trust one another. And there will always be the human being that will exploit that to steal from us. Now, there are two ways to approach that. One is to say, well, I just won't trust anybody. That's a cure worse than the disease, frankly. Another way is to say, okay, I understand that my instinct is to trust, so I've got to protect myself from that instinct by establishing smart rules for myself and being humble about the fact that I'm going to make mistakes, the fact that I can't be sure I'm always right about the people I trust. So this tendency of ours to trust and the vulnerability that leaves for us is timeless. It applies to every aspect of our lives. Learning that we trust too well and not always wisely is an important thing to learn about ourselves so that we can protect ourselves from the harm of trusting too much and trusting the wrong person. So it's not about finance. It's not about Wall Street. It's not about money. It's about how humans relate to one another and how to protect yourself from the evil that that can cause without denying yourself all the wonderful good that that brings about.
Diana B. Enriquez is a reporter with the New York Times. Her book is The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust. For Women's Focus, I'm Megan Kamrick, and I know I can count on your support to keep this kind of programming alive on KUNM, your community-powered radio station. So please, call now with your pledge.